This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, the war on terrorism helps usher in a historic day for Northern Ireland. But first, more violence in the disputed region of Kashmir. The year-long ceasefire between Pakistan and India appears to be on the brink of collapse. Today, Indian security forces said they foiled an attack by a Pakistan-based separatist group on a strategic Air Force base in Kashmir. Four militants died in the attack, and at least 18 people were killed over the weekend in gun battles along the front lines. Anwar Iqbal covers South Asia for United Press International. He joins us from Washington. Welcome, Anwar Iqbal.
Thank you.
It was only a few days ago that U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell left this region after trying to ease tensions between India and Pakistan. Instead, things seem to have gotten worse. What's going on here?
Well, I still believe that the Secretary of State's visit to the region was a successful visit. When he went there, he never hoped to resolve the Kashmir dispute, which has been there for more than 53 years now. The purpose was to keep India and Pakistan disengaged and avoid a possible war or even border clashes between them. And I think he has succeeded in doing that.
But today, over the weekend, there were border clashes. They have engaged, and there's the word from the region is that the ceasefire appears to be on the brink of collapse.
There were no border clashes, and these were the militants who have been doing this for some time now. In fact, the current uprising, or as the Indians call it, the war of secession, it started in 1990 and has been going on since then. Muslim militants operating from the Pakistani side of Kashmir into the Indian Kashmir, and they sort of carry on blasts and car bomb attacks and all, and they run back to Pakistan. So this has been going on for some time.
But right now, with everything going on in Afghanistan and Pakistan's feared instability, people seem particularly concerned about any sign of the ceasefire breaking down. It hasn't been long since Indians were shelling across this line. There was the attack, these deaths over the weekend, and the earlier attack on the parliamentary building. Can we feel confidence that behind this violence there is an increased level of stability there, or are things spiraling in a bad direction?
Well, I do not see an immediate threat of war there, but of course things have gotten worse, and this because of the U.S.-led war against terrorism. When the terrorists attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11, Indians right away offered the United States, offered bases, military bases, as well as their territory to the United States for operations into Afghanistan. And soon after, the Pakistanis also made a similar offer. Since Pakistan was closer to Afghanistan, it has a more than 1,500-mile-long border with Afghanistan. It has been engaged with the Taliban, has played a key role in forming the Afghan militia and everything. So it was obvious that the United States should have gone for using Pakistani bases and Pakistani facilities for operation into Afghanistan, that they did. But both India and Pakistan wanted to use this situation for their benefit. The Indians wanted to use this to get the Kashmiri militant groups, to get them declared terrorist groups and terrorist outfits, and to bring as much international pressure on Pakistan as possible to stop these cross-border, although it is wrong to call that area border because it is not a border. It is what they call the ceasefire line, the line of control, because of a UN resolution that accepts Kashmir as an area disputed between India and Pakistan. Anyway,
Anwar Iqbal, thanks for your view on this tonight, and we're going to keep watching that line very closely, and we'll talk with you in the future as we follow the situation there. Thanks very
You're
much.
Welcome. Bye.
Anwar Iqbal covers South Asia for United Press International. The first victory in the war on terrorism may have been marked in the unlikely capital of Belfast, Northern Ireland today. Gerry Adams, president of Sinn Féin, urged the IRA to lay down its arms.
Our aim is to save the Good Friday Agreement. Our aim is to ensure that the threat does not succeed. And our commitment to the process is absolute. The initiatives that we have taken, the initiatives that we have encouraged others to take, including the IRA, have contributed decisively to the peace process.
But Adams also called upon the British Army to lay down its weapons.
Many Republicans are justifiably angry at the unrelenting focus on silenced IRA weapons. It's in marked contrast to the attitude to loyalist weapons and bombs in daily use and the remilitarization by the British Army of Republican heartlands in the north goes generally unnoticed. The issue of weapons must be resolved, but not just IRA weapons, British weapons as well. This is all a very necessary part of a conflict resolution process.
Many see in this groundbreaking announcement an acknowledgement of the new pressures to make peace in the wake of September 11th. Joining us now from Johannesburg, South Africa, is Purig O'Malley. He's a senior fellow at the McCormick Institute at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and author of several books on Northern Ireland. Good evening, Purig O'Malley.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Thanks for being with us. Also joining us is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beattie, with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. Good evening, Jack.
Good evening, Tom.
Listeners, can we call this move toward peace in Northern Ireland the first tangential success in the global war on terrorism? What's your view? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Purig O'Malley, you're a long way from us there, but you're very clear on the line, and thanks for joining us. It's a big day with Gerry Adams calling on the IRA to disarm. Can we chalk some of this up to the after effects of September 11th? And how big an announcement is this?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, I think Gerry Adams' speech today is one of the most significant speeches ever given by a Republican, that is, by a party connected to the IRA. Two, that when you label everything under terrorism, you distort the meaning and the history of what goes on in particular countries. For example, I was just listening into your report on Kashmir and found it astoundingly inept, if I may say so. Three, this is groundbreaking in Northern Ireland. This is groundbreaking. This is more important than the Good Friday Agreement. But in the context of the conversation we are going to have, I find it very difficult to deal with it when one deals with it is this terrorism or anti-terrorism.
Purig O'Malley, I think we understand exactly the point you're making, and we want to address it head on. I think that the perception has been that since September 11th, a kind of line has been drawn by Washington that threatens to call dissidents anywhere terrorists. And our question is, and a question to you is, might it be that part of the incentive for Sinn Féin and the IRA to look at disarmament is some fear that they might be caught on the wrong side of that line? Not because they would identify themselves as terrorists, but because the black and white has just become sharp and aggressive.
Well, I'll answer that probably with four quick replies. Number one, the whole debate, argument, whatever, about decommissioning, laying down of arms, asking the IRA to lay down arms, has been going on for over 2 years. Many parties have been involved, the United States, South Africa in particular, of course the governments of both Great Britain and the Republic of Ireland. Two, the when Sinn Féin signed up to, that is the political arm of the IRA, signed up to the Good Friday Agreement, they signed up to a clause, the first clause in the agreement, that they agreed that the status of Northern Ireland as part of the United Kingdom would not change until a majority of the people in Northern Ireland decided in a free and fair referendum to change that status, which means that if ever the IRA went back to quote-unquote war, there would be no war to go back to because they had already given their agreement to what the status of Northern Ireland is.
Mm-hmm.
Four, and perhaps decisively, is two things. One is the Colombian connection of the IRA with FARC. And two, the fact that after September the 11th, the world as regards the way armed conflicts are regarded has changed. If the IRA, for any reason, were to go back to a war, which would be supported by a minority of a minority of a minority,
mm-hmm.
and then the British government would perforce of its alliance with the United States in particular, would have to crack down immediately on them. And two, the IRA would have no support at all. And let me just add in this context, and perhaps your viewers in the United States or listeners would not understand this, but Ireland is the only country in the world which declared a national day of mourning after the attack on the World Trade Center. That means every business closed down, transportation closed down, and perhaps most importantly, and I say this kind of jokingly, from an Irish point of view, even the pubs closed down for a whole day.
A dramatic Nothing step indeed.
In the country, and we're the only country in the world that did that. And that to send a message to Sinn Féin. What Gerry Adams did today is mind-breaking in the sense that if you look at an organization that has believed for over 100 years that only the use of physical force can achieve political ends, has decided that that is not the case.
It is a banner day in those terms, and certainly here in Boston we understand the links of sympathy and connection that link Ireland and the United States. We're going to take a quick break, but just before we do, Jack Beattie, you hear both the slow march toward this that people have poured so much effort into over time and the post-September 11th dynamic kicking in here in some dimension as well.
Yeah, these are events long in train. I mean, not just since the Good Friday Agreement, but for years, really. But September 11th added something. It was the catalyst, clearly, and changed the context for the IRA, as it did really for Yasser Arafat, who looks a lot like Gerry Adams these days, trying to catch a train that may leave the station without him.
Pearl O'Malley, please hang on in South Africa. We're talking this hour about Gerry Adams' groundbreaking call today for the IRA to disarm, to put down the arms that have defined its resistance against the United Kingdom for such a long time. How does the new atmosphere created in the aftermath of September 11th figure into this landmark day? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us online at wbur.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
from Boston.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about Jerry Adams urging today the IRA to disarm, a landmark day in the history of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Earlier today, I spoke with Dennis Murray, Northern Ireland correspondent for the BBC. Dennis was at Jerry Adams' speech today at Conway Mill in Belfast. I asked him to describe the mood of the people there.
It had been advertised by Jerry Adams himself and by Sinn Féin as a significant speech. And I think one of the significant things about the speech was not just the words, but the people who were in the room. There were very senior Republicans from all across Northern Ireland and from the Irish Republic present. Also people who, frankly, you would have associated more with the IRA than Sinn Féin, if you accept there's a difference between them.
All of this giving credibility to the call.
A united front, I would have said, and that was one of the lines in Jerry Adams' speech. Now, a lot of the speech was taken up with, Republicans should go home, think about this, debate it. But one has to believe, honestly, that really Republicans have done their groundwork before this. I mean, Jerry Adams and Martin McGuinness are two very smart politicians, and they have always done their selling first and announced the decision afterwards.
Is there been reaction outside the meeting place today? How's it going down in Northern Ireland?
It's going down pretty well. Some Protestant church leaders have welcomed it. The central government, if you like, the Northern Ireland Secretary of State, John Reid, member of the cabinet, he said it was highly significant. The Ulster Unionists, and I suppose their reaction is the most significant, were saying that, you know, that Martin McGuinness and Jerry Adams would not have done this unless they believed the IRA were going to do something. And the chief constable of the RUC, Sir Ronnie Flanagan, said much the same thing. Now, Ian Paisley of the Democratic Unionists, as you would expect, dismissed it. They feel that, you know, Republicans have told lies all along, and how can you trust a word they say? They'd like to see it for themselves. But I mean, if this, it's not a breakthrough yet. If the IRA do something on decommissioning its weapons, well, you know, that really will be history. They haven't done it yet. But I must say, you do get the feeling at the moment that there's been a sequence of events. I cannot believe that Jerry Adams in Belfast and Martin McGuinness in the United States would do pretty identical speeches at pretty much the same time unless they knew what was going to happen.
Dennis Murray, have the September 11th terrorist attacks in the United States and their aftermath, the call for a global war on terrorism, has all that changed the broader context of Northern Ireland's conflict?
Without question. Now, the very interesting thing at the Sinn Féin annual conference a couple of weeks ago in Dublin, not only did Jerry Adams say that terrorism was ethically indefensible, but the US ambassador to Dublin was at the conference and had a photo call with Jerry Adams. Now, one reading of that even at the time was, is there a bit of a quid pro quo going on here? Why would the US ambassador be seen with a political party who arguably have a private army with a huge store of weapons if the US administration didn't think something was going to happen?
What about the British government? Have they been preparing to try to paint the IRA as a fair target in Washington's new global war on terrorism?
No, I don't think so. Tony Blair was thrown a question not long after the 11th of September about, you know, come on, it's time to make your mind up about Sinn Féin stroke IRA, because a lot of people think the two organisations are the same organisation. And he said it was perfectly legitimate and perfectly credible to, on the one hand, wage war against international terrorism, and at the same time to encourage a peace process, be it Northern Ireland or the Middle East. Now, if this all does fall into place in Northern Ireland, there are people in the Middle East looking out on this. There are other peace processes who are looking to Northern Ireland for an example. Now, I'm not suggesting that Northern Ireland is, you know, the worst conflict on the planet in terms of conflict resolution. At the same time, what has happened so far and already in the Northern Ireland process has been an example to the rest of the world. Should an organisation like the IRA say, yes, we will put weapons that the international observers, who are people of international standing, they've seen the weapons and they say, yes, they are considerable, they are ready for use and so on and so forth. Should those be put beyond use, then that would be a substantial gesture.
That was Dennis Murray with the BBC in Belfast. We're talking this evening about the dramatic announcement today from Jerry Adams calling on the IRA to disarm. and what that means for Northern Ireland, what it may mean for the world, and how the aftermath of September 11th may sit in the backdrop of this decision, this call. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined this evening from Johannesburg, South Africa, by Purug O'Malley, a senior fellow at the McCormick Institute at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and by special coverage news analyst Jack Beattie. Purug O'Malley, you heard those comments. Of course, there was a note of skepticism there, but yet clearly the sense that something big is afoot here, even the notion that Northern Ireland could become a model for disarming. Can you see that emerging in this new period?
I would be skeptical about that. I think every situation of disarming is individual.
Mm-hmm.
Two, that the conflict in Northern Ireland has its unique characteristics that are not carried over to other civil conflicts. Three, that the issue of the laying down of arms or decommissioning has been talked about by groups both from America, South Africa, from other places around the world for the last 2.5 years. So it's nothing new in the making. Fourth, that again, that there is inevitability to the way historical processes work. And the inevitability at this point was, of course, the 11th of September, because it changed the context in which everything in Northern Ireland could be looked at if the IRA ever again were to resort to arms. Mm. The pressure put on Martin McGuinness, for example, the chief negotiator for the IRA, is in Washington today talking with Richard Haass.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Haass also happens to be the man who is the special representative of the United States regarding Afghanistan. The pressure has built up on many fronts.
We're impressed now, with the web of with the web of pressures here, and we note that you are in South Africa now. In his speech today, Gerry Adams mentioned that he'd recently traveled to South Africa and spoken to former President Nelson Mandela and others about the Northern Ireland crisis. What's the connection between Mandela and the ANC and Adams and the IRA? How does it fit together?
The South Africa and Northern Ireland have enjoyed a unique relationship since the release of Nelson Mandela in 1990. The ANC and the IRA have always claimed a special relationship, or at least the IRA have claimed a special relationship with the ANC. When Gerry Adams was here, former President Nelson Mandela and people close to him who are supporters of decommissioning, the demilitarization in Northern Ireland, gave him a message. And the message essentially was that in 1990, after Mandela was released, mm-hmm. he went before his supporters and he said, I am going to declare a unilateral ceasefire. And he got up and he said mm-hmm. to the Afrikaners mm-hmm. and the government, the war is over.
Mm-hmm.
And they declared the end of violence. Now, when the IRA have got to respond to what Sinn Féin has said, and the key will be not so much how much arms they actually destroy or whatever. The key will be whether or not the IRA says the war is over. If they say the war is over, then certain things can happen. That means that a relationship can be established between Gerry Adams and David Trimble. because between Gerry Adams and David Trimble,
head of the Ulster Unionists,
Northern Ireland lies. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They must work together. If they do not work together, they need not like each other. They need not even trust each other, but they must respect each other. And if David Trimble, right now, if I were David Trimble, I would use a line from Seamus Heaney, and that is, whatever you say, say nothing. The next move is up. Don't respond. The next move is up to the IRA. They must now do something that is publicly seen to be done, but it must be seen to be done, as has been made clear, not in response to British pressure or unionist pressure, but because, and this is the key if you read through the speech that Gerry Adams gave, that they are doing and making the plea to the IRA because they think at this point in time it is the right thing to do in order to save the peace process. They are not doing it in response to British pressure. They are not doing it in response to unionist pressure. However, when you mentioned that Gerry Adams was in South Africa,
yes,
2 weeks ago, which he was, and when I met him and talked to him, and talked to him about the meetings he had, is that they will respond to what somebody like Nelson Mandela says, because Nelson Mandela is an icon, and Nelson Mandela can create and has been one of the instruments in creating the space that allows them to, the IRA, to take action.
And now Mandela finds himself and his sway there, perhaps bolstered by a new environment globally, politically and otherwise, since September 11th. Gerry Adams was very clear, as you say, that this was not bowing to British terms. It was their own decision. He said today, it is a time for clear heads and brave hearts. The IRA must stand out as an example of a people's army in touch with the people, responsive to their needs and enjoying their genuine allegiance and support. Jack Beattie, what do you hear in those words? Is he acknowledging that the populace that the IRA appeals to may have a different view of how things ought to be proceeding now?
It sounds that way, but this could be an occasion where another line of Seamus Heaney's comes in. He talks about the moments, rare moments in history, when, as he puts it, hope and history rhyme. This could be one of them in Northern Ireland. This has been going on for 30 years, and that should be sobering to us Americans. The war on terrorism there is, however Porrick wants to call it. The IRA-British conflict has been going on for 30 years and is only ending not in victory but in a kind of a negotiation. That's a sobering precedent. This has all happened in an area the size of about, what, New England or maybe even less. People all speak the same language. There have been and yet it's taken 30 years. That's a very I've seen estimates that there were as few as 500 armed people in the IRA in recent years, and yet that's enough to keep to generate a momentum of fear and to affect Irish and British politics. So, on one hand, this is a very hopeful development, but on the other hand, look at how long it's taken and with what horrible consequences for the last 30 years for all the people of Ireland and the United Kingdom.
Jack, does it seem realistic to you that this post-September 11th atmosphere dynamic may have intervened or been a significant factor in Gerry Adams' decision to come out with this call today?
I just think you can't see it in any other way. It is the catalyst. These things happen. You know, events can change history. I mean, sometimes things that have been in development, they're speeded up, and this accelerated things. Especially with this business of the Bush administration's effort to deal with the money laundering situation, which apparently, from what people say, the sort of Caribbean sluice gates for this international terrorism. Part of it affects the IRA, and any crackdown on that element of things would have starved them of funds.
Jack? How would that work? You mean that their source of funds would come through nations which are now being feeling the tighter?
And that the whole process is going to be of international banking is going to be scrutinized much more carefully, and international flows of money and so on. But you've got to hand it to Gerry Adams. He's seen a moment of history, and I think Mandela probably told him, you know, that real opportunities come very rare, and this is one. And you can redeem the time here and step up to it and break the logjam, because this situation in Northern Ireland was heading downhill, as I think most analysts agree with. They were heading toward direct rule again from Britain.
Certainly, it was looking dicey. We're talking about Northern Ireland, and Gerry Adams' call today for the IRA to decommission its arms, a historic call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. How do you think it does or doesn't fit into the dynamic of the post-September 11th world? Bob is on the line. Welcome, Bob. You're on the air.
Hello. I think Gerry Adams' speech today, I've just flown back from Britain, by the way. I just drove back from Boston. I was listening to your program, so I just didn't want to call you on the car phone, so I've sort of got home and rung you up on this.
Fresh as can be. We're glad to have you.
Okay. It definitely does have, September 11th must have played a big hand in Gerry Adams deciding on this, and I can tell you that the sentiments in Britain have not always been very positive about Gerry Adams or the IRA. I was in Manchester,
to say the least.
I was in Manchester when the bomb went off in the centre of Manchester, and it's taken Manchester about 6 years to put itself back on track. So there's a lot of anti-IRA sentiments because of that, and I think at the same time there's always been a lot of double-handed handling of the IRA in the U.S. because many places in around Boston, where I'm calling you from, were collecting money for the IRA for a long time, when IRA clearly was planting bombs in London, in various cities in Britain. And when the bomb went off in Manchester, a few days later another bomb went off in Macclesfield, which is just outside Manchester, and a 10-year-old boy was killed. The one in Manchester, actually, three people got killed. So in the space of a week, four people got killed in the Lancashire area, in the Lancashire county. Mm.
Bob, we've got it. Jack Beattie, what about this point? May the base of support in the United States for the IRA have been diminished by September 11?
You have to suppose that it has been. I mean, people have gotten serious now about terrorism, and just to call the IRA terrorists just in this new context, as you're saying, people who use violence against civilians to make political points are terrorists, and the world has changed for them. They're on the run now.
We're talking about Gerry Adams' big announcement today in Northern Ireland, calling for the IRA to decommission its arms. We're at 1-800-423-8255. How do you see that fitting into the post-September 11th world? You can join online at WBOR.org. Click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about Gerry Adams' call today for the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, to disarm, a historic call which may soon have historic consequences. Do you think this may be related to the new world dynamic emerging since September 11th? Let us know. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined from Johannesburg, South Africa, by Purag O'Malley, a senior fellow at the McCormick Institute at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Purag O'Malley, I want to put Jack Beattie's last point to you, if I may. And I guess the really interesting thing at the heart of this is, we talk about freedom fighters, we talk about terrorists, but is there access to any moral claim in violent action after 9/11, whether you call yourself a freedom fighter or whatever? Can anyone hope to use violence now and still hold a moral claim?
I'm glad you asked that question, Tom, because I was going to ask you whether it was possible over the line to talk to Jack Beattie for about a minute or two.
Please, he's right on the line with you.
He is. Hello?
Hello.
Hi, Jack.
Hello.
This is Pork
yes.
O'Malley.
Indeed.
And as you know, I've admired your writing for many a year. But let me ask you this question, because I think this is very important. There are at the moment in Africa itself 60 conflicts going on at the moment. That's just in Africa. I will not speak for the rest of the world. Each conflict, to me, has its unique circumstances and experiences and history. And unless we, it would appear to me, learn to understand what are the causes and the natures of those conflicts and why those conflicts lead to violence, then we will never resolve the question of the use of violence. Now, I use the phrase the use of violence rather than trying to label everything. I think it does an injustice to discussion to label everything terrorism, non-terrorism.
And yet, Jack Beatty, we can see that that's exactly what's beginning to go on here with the lines that George Bush is drawing. What about Purig O'Malley's point?
Well, you know, was it President Reagan who said one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist? Well, for my own part, I tend to look at this at Tolstoy. He said, you know, the difference between the violence of the left and the violence of the right was the difference between dog excrement and cat excrement. Ethically, this is bad stuff. Ethically, the doing of murder to make a political point is just about as bad as it gets. I don't care if you call it banana rather than terrorism. It's odious. And for too long, it has been a fixture of 20th century life. Of course, at the other end, we've had mass state violence, the war of states on bombing civilians. And now we have civilians making war on other civilians. But I do think there was a moral watershed crossed. I agree with you, Tom, on September 11th. People can't anymore say, well, they're killing these people to make a point because they're oppressed. That won't cut it anymore.
But
an argument.
But Jack, let me put that to Purig O'Malley, because he points out that there are real conflicts. Yes, please. There are real conflicts.
Jack, I'm asking you a direct question. Do you believe that in it's a war against apartheid, where the ANC had exhausted every measure, that the government would not talk to them, imprison them, detain them, would not entertain any measure of freedom at all, and they resorted to. In fact, Nelson Mandela was the person who founded the armed movement Umkhonto Sizwe, an African, the MK, who founded the armed movement and said, we must fight a government that does not listen to us, who oppresses us completely.
Purig O'Malley, we have just time for a response to that. Jack Beatty?
Well, in that situation, I suppose they're backwards to the wall. That hasn't been the situation of the IRA. Britain is a democracy, and there's a way of influencing public opinion short of murder and violence. And I think that is a crucial difference. When you use violence against democracy, it's a very different moral context from using violence against an oppressive regime that will not talk to you. The one can be a strange instrument of democracy, as it was in South Africa, because it represents the cause of the majority. The other, the use of minority violence against the majority, is more like totalitarianism.
Purig O'Malley, we thank you for the points you've raised this evening. I think we're going to be chewing on them for a long time as we look ahead across many countries and many situations. Thanks very much for joining us. And Jack, always good to be with you. Listeners, you can read the full text of Gerry Adams' speech made today in Belfast on our website. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. For years now, Afghanistan has been associated with Kalashnikov rifles, Stinger missiles, and military woe. But there is, of course, much more to this ancient culture. The scholar Louis Dupree has called Afghanistan a nation of poets. The country has long been the wellspring of Central Asian literature and a setting for Western literary inspiration. This week, we'll look at the literary side of Afghanistan and what it reveals about the character and culture of the nation in America's gun sights. We start today with the ancient art of storytelling.
A grammarian once embarked in a boat. Turning to the boatman with a self-satisfied air, he asked, "Have you ever studied grammar?" "No," replied the boatman. "Then half your life has gone to waste," the grammarian said. The boatman thereupon felt very depressed, but he answered him nothing for the moment. Presently, the wind tossed the boat into a whirlpool. The boatman shouted to the grammarian, "Do you know how to swim?" "No," the grammarian replied, "my well-spoken, handsome fellow." "In that case, grammarian," the boatman remarked, "the whole of your life has gone to waste, for the boat is sinking in these whirlpools." You may be the greatest scholar in the world in your time, but consider, my friend, how the world passes away and time.
3/4 of the population of Afghanistan cannot read, so people rely on oral narratives to entertain and educate. These anecdotes and stories, musical and spoken, are handed down from generation to generation. Here to talk more on the oral narrative tradition in Afghanistan is Margaret Mills, chair of the Near Eastern Languages and Cultures Department at Ohio State University and author of Rhetorics and Politics in Afghan Traditional Storytelling. Margaret Mills, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We just heard one quick story there. It's from the oral tradition. Tell us about the importance of the oral tradition of storytelling in Afghan culture.
Well, actually, to back up a little bit, that story certainly is readily available in oral tradition in a lot of places, but it is probably one of the more famous stories from the Masnavi-Manavi, the spiritual quatrains of Jalaluddin Rumi. In fact, that work is a cornucopia of stories that are also known in oral tradition. When you think about Afghanistan, it's well to remind ourselves that at maximum, there might be something like 25 or 30% functional literacy, which means people can write their name and maybe decipher a line of the Quran, the minimal literacy. And then, of course, there are people who are highly literate and have a great deal of education. But by far, something on the order of 70% of the population has no reading and writing skills at all.
So is there a tradition alive right now of people sitting around and sharing stories passed down over centuries?
Yes, certainly. And I think that it comes to play, as does narrative in our culture to some extent, when people really need to make sense out of chaotic situations. They look for scenarios and causal themes that they know about. So they reach for narrative and they reach for traditional narratives to make sense out of life. And this has been true, you know, over centuries, and certainly richly true for Afghans, that often if you want to make a moral point to someone, what you do is tell a story, and if they get the connection, then they get it. And if they don't get it, there's a famous proverb in Persian that the answer to a fool is silence. If you didn't get it, you didn't get it.
The story we heard just a minute ago seems to suggest a kind of deep pragmatism.
Yes.
No matter how fancy the grammarian's view of the world, the boatman knows you have to be able to swim.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this story is quite likely to ring very true for Afghans who see us going in with highly sophisticated, highly technological approaches to life, and what they don't really know is where the whirlpool is and how to swim when you don't have your equipment.
Are there other stories that are popular on the oral tradition circuit in Afghanistan in recent years?
Well, yeah, there's stuff that is also very literary that I think can be brought to bear, and there's other things that are what we would consider to be jokes. Maybe a quick one-liner is in order. This was told about the time that the Soviets were leaving after 10 years. It was a question and answer, and the first question was, why did the Soviets come to Afghanistan? And the answer is they were invited.
Mm-hmm.
And then, well, why did they stay so long? Oh, they were looking for the guy who invited them. That was an Afghan joke, and I wouldn't
be
all surprised that that's being recycled or will be soon. Mm-hmm. Another that is, again, one of these oral literary things is a story about the bear's friend,
mm-hmm.
which turns up in another mystical poet, Jami, who's the poet of Herat, a city that we've just been hearing about in the news. And the story goes that a man had befriended a bear cub and raised him up, and they were good friends, and the bear was inseparable with his buddy. And one day he was sitting with his human friend while the human friend was taking a nap, and a fly kept landing on the man's forehead, and the bear kept trying to brush it away, and the fly would come back, and finally the bear got really mad, and he got a big rock, and he coshed the fly on his friend's forehead with the rock, and of course he killed his friend. So the point is, you really need to choose friends who are wise, and that's probably something that Afghans are thinking about pretty intensely right now.
Presumably, many Afghans are right now thinking about how to look at the United States anew and whether or not we're a dangerous bear or a valuable friend.
Right, I think so. I would.
Mm. What do you think is most important for Americans to take away from the Afghan oral tradition in terms of understanding aspects of that culture that we may need to understand in the months and years ahead?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is how very much of kind of moral commentary is mediated indirectly. Like, you won't necessarily get people saying, here's what you need to know and here's what you need to think. But you get indirect statements that need to be read as reflections on actual events. But besides that, also, as in a lot of oral traditions, there's an enormous thematic emphasis in Afghan oral literature on justice and on underdogs who somehow manage to secure justice against all odds. And I don't think it's hard to see the country, its general population, as being pretty obvious underdogs at this point. This is to say, you know, to hold apart the issues of the Taliban and Osama and their role in geopolitics at this point. Most of the population there has virtually nothing, and they're going to have less. And so the ability to secure justice from a position of weakness, which is really, really widespread in Afghan oral tradition, is going to be a theme that will be on people's minds.
Are Afghan children still learning these stories today, even in the disruption that currently afflicts the country?
I wonder. I think probably my guess would be, because of the way the Taliban have shut down the media, that what there is of oral tradition is, you know, God help it, thriving. But I also know that because of the interruptions of widespread refugeedom in the 80s, people who were major carriers of oral tradition lost the opportunity to share that tradition. And when I went back to Herat briefly in the 90s, I found a generation my own age, you know, 40, 50, 60-year-olds who were desperate to get cultural knowledge back in place, but they were looking at a young generation that had been displaced in such a way that they just didn't have access to it. Certainly, things like political humor are desperately needed in desperate situations, and I'm sure that that's thriving.
And those traditions tend to be very durable, even in circumstances of great trial.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a story, again, this one was told right about the time of the Soviet invasion. And the story goes that there was a mountain kingdom that was besieged, and eventually the conquerors came riding in, and they came into the capital, and they marched into the room of government. At the top end of that room was a high seat, which was empty, and the conquering general walked in and said, "What's that?" And the elders of the conquered people said, "Oh, that's the high seat of our government. That's where our leader sits." And the general smiled, and he marched up and sat in the seat, and then the conquered elders smiled too, because that seat was kept empty. That was the seat of their god, and they knew that if somebody sat in that seat, people would rise up and kick them out.
There, from the great Afghan oral tradition, a lesson on how not to walk into Afghan as a conqueror. Margaret Mills, thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
Margaret Mills is chair of the Near Eastern Languages and Cultures Department at Ohio State University. Coming up tomorrow in part two of our series on the literature of Afghanistan, learning about the Afghan people through their classical writers. For comprehensive coverage of the aftermath of the September 11th attacks and to listen to past programs, check out our website at wbur.org. Click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.